Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm at the Noel Coward Theatre, sitting in an empty, more or less, auditorium, but with things happening on stage, which may occasionally be heard on this recording. And I'm joined by Susanna Fielding, who plays Hermia in Michael Grandage's production of Midsummer Night's Dream, in which David Walliams plays Bottom and Sheridan Smith Titania and Hippolyta. Well, welcome, Susanna.
Hello.
You've done quite a bit of Shakespeare before, at least you've done some rather significant productions, because you were in Much Ado About Nothing at the NT, you were Hero.
That's right.
When Simon Russell Beale and Zoe Wanamaker had Beatrice and Benedict.
Yeah.
And you were in Rupert Gould's famous Merchant, the RSC, when you were Portia.
That's right, yeah, that's a very special production for me. Mm. We were lucky enough to have 2 months to rehearse that, because at the RSC we're often in more than one production, so they were rehearsing Macbeth and Merchant of Venice alongside each other, and as I had such a big role, I was only in one production, so we had a lovely long rehearsal period and a very creative one where we set the whole play in Las Vegas, and Portia's world was that of a reality TV show, and Shylock's was that of a casino, so it was off the wall, but I think worked brilliantly. Yeah. Very proud of that one.
Well, you're in an unusual Midsummer Night's Dream as well, mm-hmm. because this one is set, is it sort of late 60s, would you say?
It's unspecific in terms of where exactly and what and when exactly it's set, but the fairies definitely kind of are evocative of the 70s festival period. But there's also
a bit like Summer of Love.
Exactly, and the music from that era definitely appears. But there's also elements of the Burning Man Festival, which goes on today, and cool sort of forward-thinking people from San Francisco started going out and having, I think the festival started on a beach somewhere and then they were asked to move, and now it's this hugely growing festival where people come and bring art and themselves and
thousands of people
and there's no electricity or anything there, so you have to bring your own generators and your own ideas, really. For
so the relationship between that and this production is the transformative nature of art and being somewhere else strange.
Exactly, being outside of a city, which of course we are. We start off in Athens in a court, and very quickly the lovers find themselves in a place outside of the city where hopefully their horizons are broadened and strange and wonderful things happen in a way that they may not in a more constrained societal setting.
Because what you are threatened with as Hermia is pretty awful, really, because you don't want to marry the man your father wants you to marry. You're threatened with death or a convent.
Exactly.
That's pretty tough.
I know. I think I hadn't really realised until I actually did the play, the stakes of that first scene are so high. And it's an ancient law of Athens that if a daughter does not obey her father, she can be put to death or sent to a convent. And he says a couple of times, and she is mine. So we're very much operating within a world where women do not have their own voice and their own power in the way that we do now.
So it's pretty brave of her to run away.
Brave of her to run away, and she absolutely stands up for herself in that court setting. Mm. She says, I know not by what power I am made bold. There's something in her which maybe she's a forward-thinking young woman, I think, and a strong young woman. No sign of her mother, as is often the case in Shakespeare's plays, but I like to think that it came from her. That's my backstory.
Yes. Ah, right. Did you do a lot of work on backstories? I was wondering particularly about your relationship with Helena, because you seem to have grown up together and been quite close until Maine got in the way.
Exactly, yes. I guess it's often the case, isn't it, when you're in your teenage years, as these girls sort of are.
So you're thinking of them as teenage sort of 16 or something.
Both Catherine and myself aren't teenagers, but I suppose in the setting that you meet the characters, you know, they are younger than we are. But there's a certain innocence, I suppose, that we're pulling from that, and a protectedness as well, I suppose, that we've brought into our version of it.
So you see yourself as school friends who are close, and probably used to bantering as well, though.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a real shorthand between these two girls. And as you see in the fight scene, they know exactly each other's Achilles heels.
Yes, so they know how to hurt.
Exactly. She goes straight for the puppet you.
I like your line, I know not what to say.
There's
absolutely nothing more to say.
Exactly. I'm so perplexed. And I think Hermia has never seen Helena be quite so bold and so confident with her words. So that's something she's found in the forest, I can only assume. So the whole seeing her come out of herself like that is as extraordinary as what she says.
Yes, because you start off being much the more confident and
absolutely
sure of yourself as a person.
Mm-hmm.
She's
sort of trailing behind
really,
asking for advice on how to speak and how to look and how to get the boys.
Yes.
Their roles are very much reversed within the
So is that what because the forest, of course, is a place of transformation and change.
Exactly.
So is that what happens to you? You get some idea what it's like not to be the favourite, the most
golden
popular
child,
girl.
The most popular girl at school, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a massive lesson and a good one for her to have learnt. There are elements of Hermia's character where I think she's quite spoilt and quite used to having her own way, which is why, you know, when this situation with Lysander happens, it's all the more grave for her, because she's never been told no, I don't think. So for her, it's very much about probably learning humility and learning to value people, I think, as well.
Yes. Well, you're obviously used to speaking Shakespeare's lines, but in this one, as well as having a lot of the most famous insults that arrive in insult books, they're so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
Painted maypole and so on.
Yeah.
You also use a lot of rhyme as well as blank verse. So did you find it that it made a difference to the way you delivered the lines when there was rhyme?
I always start from a place of just trying to make it sound real. And obviously you're honouring any kind of alliteration or rhyme or particular rhythm in a line as much as possible.
Mm.
But I try not to focus too much on that. I try to acknowledge where it is and then speak to the other person as if they're a real person.
Right. So the rhyme sort of intrudes that, not in a bad way, but I mean, it is quite funny, isn't it?
Absolutely. There definitely are. For example, at the end of the fight scene, Helena says, "My legs are longer though to run away."
Yeah.
And I say, "I'm amazed and know not what to say." So Shakespeare's giving you a lovely, nice little bow at the end there to tie everything up, and hopefully for the audience to feel that sense of, "Oh, that's the end of that."
That's the end of that bit.
Exactly. So there are elements like that where of course that really helps you. You don't want to push it too hard, I suppose, is what I mean.
Yes. But it's sort of taken up. Well, there is quite a bit of rhyme in the play, but it's funniest, of course, in the Mechanicals play.
Yes.
But it's kind of a parody of this.
That's
of this
right.
Another
that
scene.
What bad writing can be. Yes. Yeah. I see a. What does he say? I hear a face, or I see a voice, or something like that.
Yes, and, I see a voice.
Yeah.
But the set is dominated by a huge moon, isn't it? Did you talk a lot about moons and phases and the because it's. And the word moon occurs quite a lot in the play as
well.
It does.
Even the play within a play has a character called Moon. We saw a model box setting at the beginning of the rehearsal period, day one, I think, with Christopher Oram's amazing design, which gave us huge amounts of inspiration, obviously, for there's something about dancing under the moon and the kind of Bacchic nature of that, I think, which very much fed into the fairy world. And it's a wonderful way of showing how lonely people can be, standing on your own in front of a massive moon that's sort of 18 metres high or whatever it is. There's nothing better to make you feel small and insignificant. I think the fairies concentrated a lot more on that than the lovers did.
Yes, because you move between the worlds. I mean, it's... and gradually lose not only inhibitions but clothes.
Yes. A comic device. I like to think that they're sort of dragged off in fights and by trees, and also that the heat of running around and all the emotion of it leads to that.
And of course we end up with just four young people. They no longer have the niceties and the proper behaviour of the court.
Exactly, yes. They're not sort of done up, and any kind of hierarchy and class system dissolves, which is also very good for them, I should think.
Yes. I was surprised that Hippolyta didn't take your side a bit more, she often does now. Oh, there's somebody testing. Sounds like kissing down the line.
It does. Hello.
Very suitable for this production. That Hippolyta doesn't, as she often does in productions now, sort of side with you against Theseus.
Well, it's interesting. We did have that conversation in rehearsals a lot, and whether she was happy with what was going on. Sheridan and myself...
That's Sheridan Smith playing Titania.
And also Hippolyta. plays Hippolyta. We have secret looks between us, so when she's leaving the stage, I say, please, and she says, I don't know what I can do. Mm. And then... we have made up a backstory that she is the one that bends Theseus's ear.
Right.
And so when in the last scene of the play, Theseus says, Aegeus, I will overbear your will. I won't let you have your way and kill Hermia if she doesn't marry Demetrius. She gives me a wink and I say thank you.
Right.
So I know that there is, very often that's played more overtly, but there's no text to support it, for one. Or to exercise that idea. So I think women had to operate within a slightly more under the surface power.
Yes. Although Hippolyta is an Amazon.
She's a strong woman, no doubt. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
But on the other hand, she has been won in battle, so it's a bit double-edged, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be construed in so many ways, can't it? And I'd really like to see a performance where she's clearly the one, you know, who's ruling the roost as well. I think they're both equally valid, yeah.
Yes, well, the recent Globe production actually had a mime of the battle at the beginning.
Right, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
So that... gave you her context, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as people often say, whose dream is it? Bottom says he has a dream, of course, but he doesn't really know what's happened to him. But you are the only one who actually does have a dream. It's a nightmare, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite significant, isn't it? I mean, have you talked about the symbolism of it or whatever? Because she's quite frightened.
She's very frightened, yeah.
This is when she wakes up on her own.
That's right.
Lysander has gone.
Lysander, help me.
And she thinks he's just a few feet away. She doesn't realise the potion's been put into his eye and he's gone off looking for Helena.
She's one of the characters that doesn't have any potion magic put on her as well. So I can only assume that that's sort of Shakespeare's device for showing that she's been as affected by the wood as some of the other characters. But yeah, it's a real nightmare, and it's about a serpent eating her heart away and Lysander watching and smiling and not helping her. And so it's definitely a metaphor for what's just happened on stage prior to that in the case of him being so duplicitous and suddenly falling in love with Helena and running off.
Yes. For once, actually, you and Helena are beautifully cast because you're so different. I mean, you are actually as described by Shakespeare, which is very nice.
Yeah, I guess it is nice, isn't it, to see? it's all in the text as well.
It's
one of those casting things where it kind of does have to be as accurate as possible, I think. Otherwise, the audience are sitting there going, well, hang on, she's not that much taller than her.
Exactly, yes. Oh, I see, she's wearing heels.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, so we found a lovely leggy blonde and a short brunette. So Michael Grandish did well.
Yes, well, I was told you were going to have to remove your wig. It looks so... I didn't realise it was a wig. It looks so...
Yeah, hence me wearing this ridiculous little
stocking
cap.
So this is between
cap.
Times?
Exactly, in between shows. So
I expect it's rather hot, isn't it, the wig?
Well, it does get quite sweaty out there, although since the weather's cooled down, it's not quite so bad. But, yeah, I was slightly concerned it would fall off in the fight scene because we have a very physical scene 6, but it's always managed to stay on. There's about 1,400 grips in there, keeping it in place.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy all that physical stuff? It looks... quite demanding.
I love it, actually. And it's one of those scenes where you come on, you say your first line, and you don't have time to think until you 20 minutes later when it's over and you're running off, which I love. You have to be so present, not only because it's a very quick, fast-paced scene, but also because you have to be so focused with the physical stuff to make sure you get it right and don't hurt each other, which we never have, touch wood.
When you how does Michael Grandage rehearse? Did you do a lot of table work to start with?
Straight up on your feet,
right?
Which I really like. And we talk as we go along. And he's an incredible director, and I've always wanted to work with him. So it's been a dream come true. And he's very, very good at asking the right questions and getting you to think about relationships and your own motivations in various scenes, and he doesn't ever gloss over something. Every question is answered, and everyone knows exactly what they're saying. He did a lot of work on that at the beginning, making sure that everyone knew what they were saying down to the last syllable, and that everyone on stage knew that what they were saying.
And are you all in rehearsals, or have you all been in rehearsals some of the time together?
Yeah, that was also... because it's quite a separate play, of course.
It is, yes.
You've got two very distinct worlds, and you don't really cross over that much, so... yeah, he was very good at making sure that we had full company calls on a regular basis to keep us all united, and so we felt like we were in the same play.
That's good. Mm. And then at the end, of course, it always feels all resolved, and then you say, oh, no, we haven't had the play within the play yet. And then
the marriage has happened and everything,
So, but then you watch that night after night after night. Is that...
Well, I thought I would get bored, you know, if I'm being honest, but... they're so good and they're so creative.
Do they change it a bit?
Yeah, it's always slightly different, and they involve us as their audience very well. So I really enjoy watching it and seeing, you know, the intricacies sort of being changed, and some nights certain joke landing really well and other nights it going for nothing and trying to work out why. And I find all of that really fascinating.
Yes.
I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to things like that.
Well, our matinee's different too. Because I had to make my way through a huge crowd of very excited young people outside.
Yeah.
But you get a lot of young people, you say.
We do, yeah. It's
partly
fantastic.
Because of David Walliams. And they will have seen Sheridan as well on television.
That's right. Yeah, so Sheridan's got a big kind of following and David has written a lot. Children's books that David's written has brought a lot of young members of the audience, which is absolutely fantastic. And I love the fact that there are people, you know, from age 7 here up to age 75 or 80 or 90, and that they're both enjoying it. I think that's exactly as it should be. And it's great that we're getting kids coming in to see the show, and their first experience of Shakespeare is a positive, fun one, hopefully.
Matinees
quite often do tend to have a younger audience.
Which is good, because matinees are often rather old.
Yeah, they can be a bit stuffy, exactly. It's been a really nice varied houses, but always full. So we're very lucky to have 900 people out there every day.
Yeah. And what about your lines as the lovers? Do they fall differently sometimes, get laughs in different places?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I find that really fascinating. Michael Grandage came to see the show again last week. And was really encouraged by how I think we'd managed to tighten bits and hone bits and nail a laugh where we weren't really getting one before. And so it was really nice for him to see the contrast.
Mm.
Of course, when you're doing it every day, you don't notice quite so much the changes.
No, but does that mean that press nights are awful because you feel... you want everyone to come back and see how it's changed in...
Yeah, the pressure on those nights
time
is extraordinarily huge. And it's not only huge for the people on stage, but for the people in the audience, because it's full of friends and family who are desperate for you to do well.
Yeah.
So they're terribly nervous. So, and your agent's there who's desperate for you to do well. And all the reviewers who, you know, probably aren't watching the play as a normal audience member would, and they've got their head in a book a lot of the time. So... it's a very false atmosphere, really. But brilliantly, Michael tends to get the press in over 4 or 5 days.
Yes.
So you don't feel quite so much pressure on one night, but it's an exhausting week, I can tell you.
Yes, I would think it must be hard on the second night when you've had the party after the first.
Oh, it is. We had two shows the following day, so there wasn't...
Oh, my goodness.
We had a matinee the following day, so, yeah, that was a bit of a struggle, that one, if anyone saw that.
And do you re-rehearse those very physical bits... not every day, presumably.
No, not every day, but we definitely keep in touch with each other and run over bits if anything's getting a little bit unclear or a little bit sort of cloudy.
Mm.
It's super important that our bodies are working.
Yes, you have to keep really fit.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm rehearsing a musical at the moment, so if I go down, I don't know what would happen, really.
Oh, goodness.
Again, touch wood.
Can you talk about it? What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing American Psycho, the musical. Yeah, so I'm rehearsing that during the day. And doing this 8 shows a week. So it's a full-on time for me.
I think I should say thank you so much for finding the time, because you haven't got very long before you've got to go on again.
No, that's right. I'm going to go and grab a microwave meal from Marks and Spencer's and then back to get my wig on. Oh. It's very glamorous.
Well, thank you very much, Susanna.
Total pleasure.
Good luck with the rest. Well, the next big thing, the musical, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.